The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
This is Wendy Byrne welcoming you to the Corvallis Civics Cafe for the third week of March. Spring hath sprung, the length of our days has overtaken the length of our nights, and we are moving closer to April with each step. On our menu today is a basic review of civic happenings, the details of city meetings of the past week, and what you might expect for the upcoming week. Let's go! Did you know that the city of Corvallis no longer has a city attorney present at each meeting? While having an attorney present for each meeting is not a requirement, those familiar with Corvallis City Council meetings likely remember the familiar sight of City Attorney Jim Brewer or David Kalum sitting at the table during meetings. With Brewer's retirement in early 2024, that relationship ended, and, in its place, the city hired a new law firm, Beery, Elsner, and Hammond. Based out of Portland, the lawyers can and do attend meetings in person or remotely, but not each and every meeting. I've made it a point to ask the City Council how the public might know if the city attorney is present during a given meeting, and the best answer I have had is that if we don't see the attorney in the room, seated at the table, or on the video screen during the meeting, they are not in attendance. Make of that information what you will. The new attorneys are more expensive than the last, and it is a cost savings to not have them at each meeting. The City Council can and does request that the city attorneys attend certain meetings, but I wonder what happens in the situations where it might be nice to have the attorneys present to help address an unforeseen situation as it evolves. Consider that to be my food for thought this week. The City Council meeting on March 17th started with two presentations. First, the Executive Director of the Arts Center of Corvallis gave the City Council the annual report for the center. For those who don't know, the Arts Center is located in the old church that is on the south side of Central Park. It provides services in partnership with the City of Corvallis Parks and Recreation Department. Their mission is to inspire creativity and contribute to the community well-being through equitable access to and engagement with the visual arts. It's a wonderful part of Corvallis, and more information about it can be found on their website at theartscenter.net. The second presentation was an update from city staff about the Downtown Parking Task Force meetings. Public Works employees Lisa Scherf and Rory Rowan brought the council up to speed on the work of the task force as a lead-up to their open house, which is scheduled for Wednesday, March 26th, in the first-floor meeting room of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library. The open house will take place from 5 to 7 p.m., with a presentation beginning at 5:30. If you cannot attend in person, you can register to watch the live broadcast. There will be no deliberating or decision-making at this open house. You can view more materials about the work of the Downtown Parking Task Force and provide feedback online at corvallisoregon.gov/parking. I have attended most of the meetings of the task force and watched the videos of the meetings that I have missed, and can assure you that the plan is not to remove free parking from downtown. However, as a city, we need to understand how best to manage all of our parking, and a modernization of parking management practices in our downtown has been underway for several years now. I appreciate that city staff is trying hard to use data to drive decisions. Curious to know more? Check out that city website, corvallisoregon.gov/parking, and attend the open house. After the presentations, there was time for community comments. As seems to be the case during most City Council meetings this year, these comments brought a little spice to the meeting. Community member Tim Roach urged the City Council to continue the discussion and take up action on the lingering issues from the Ellis versus City of Corvallis case that resulted in a federal court judge identifying that a section of our city charter violates free speech rights. As he and others have said, the people of Corvallis deserve to know how we went from one city councilor making a motion during a meeting to a $500,000 debacle. I'm with him on that. Speaking later in community comments, former City Councilor Barbara Bull presented the City Council with a memo detailing her key concerns and unanswered questions about the very same case, stating, quote, "It appears that if the city manager were to receive another anonymous complaint today, the flawed process that led to the potential removal of Councilor Ellis could repeat itself. This raises concerns that must be addressed," end quote. Again, I agree, and I would urge the City Council to work diligently and expeditiously to update policies and procedures to prevent such a situation. The balance of the City Council meeting that evening was fairly unremarkable. I'm happy to report that, during his mayor report at the end of the meeting, Mayor Mann read the Corvallis Sanctuary City Statement, and that the city manager reinforced that our police department supports the sanctuary city status. Moving on in the week, on Thursday the 20th, there was a joint work session of the City Council and the Budget Commission. The purpose of this meeting was to review the proposed capital improvement program for years 2026 through 2030. What is the capital improvement program? Also known by the acronym CIP, it is a 5-year planning document identifying capital project expenditures anticipated throughout the community. Most of the projects in it are associated with the Department of Public Works, such as transportation, water, stormwater, and wastewater projects. Additional sections focus on our airport, our city buildings, and parks and recreation capital projects. While the document as a whole is not a budget document, since years 1 and 2 of the CIP are adopted into the city's budget for the next biennium, it does inform the budget, thus the combined work session of the City Council and the Budget Commission during March. They meet, they review the projects, and at some point between now and the adoption of the city budget in June, the proposed CIP becomes the adopted CIP, and the first 2 years of it become part of the city's biennial budget. Having the work session implies that some work might be done to change some of the projects in the CIP. However, meeting attendees were dissuaded from making those efforts. As an example, for several years now, members of the City Council have been asking for a restroom to be built in Central Park, only to be told that the best way for that to happen is to put it into the CIP, which they did last year. And now that project is in the CIP, but it is on the unfunded category list. And the City Council has been told that changing the CIP at this point in the year might be too difficult. Several community comments were submitted on this very topic, so stay tuned. As always, I'm trying really hard to find out how the sausage is made in Corvallis. Apparently, it is not just about the ingredients, but also about how you blend them together. Timing is crucial. Timing, in fact, might be everything. That brings us toward the end of the week, and on Friday, the Gazette Times published an article written by Ella Hutcherson with this lead-in, quote, "Corvallis insurer offered to cover legal bills in Ellis fight. The city passed," end quote. Since we were just talking about items that impact the city budget, this article is relevant because in it, Ms. Hutcherson informs us that the city turned down an offer from the city's insurance company to cover the costs of the city's legal fight with Councillor Charlyn Ellis. Per the article, quote, "The insurance company, City County Insurance Services, has offered to defend Corvallis on all fronts in Ellis versus Corvallis," end quote. In fact, they even hired a lawyer for the city to use, but the city decided to use a different legal firm. There are more details in the article, including that the insurance company has paid some of the legal fees incurred. What is not in the article, however, is an identification of who decided to turn down the offer from City County Insurance Services. Was the full City Council consulted on this decision? Paying legal fees is part of the city budget, and the City Council is responsible for the city budget, thus should have been in the loop for making this decision. Who made the decision to say no thanks to this offer? Per the Gazette Times, quote, "City Manager Mark Shepard says he does not recall much about the city's insurer's offer," end quote. Doesn't remember? Perhaps there is something, somewhere, in writing about that. As the final accounting remains to be seen, I'm glad that the reporters of the Gazette Times continue to keep an eye on this and hope they will remain diligent in sharing any and all information they can about the financial costs of this case. Coming up next week, on March 25th, there will be a meeting of the Corvallis Climate Action Advisory Board. The City Council charges this board with helping Corvallis meet the greenhouse gas emissions target set forth in the Corvallis Climate Action Plan. Additionally, this policy advisory board provides advice on the community side of the Climate Action Plan and makes policy recommendations to the council as needed. The community is welcome and encouraged to attend Climate Action Advisory Board meetings in person or virtually. Did you know that applications for 2025 green grants are being accepted until March 31st? $5,000 in grant funds will be awarded this year to local projects and initiatives that move the dial on climate change and promote the actions of the Corvallis Climate Action Plan. A list of those actions can be found on the Climate Action Board's webpage. Green grants are intended for community-centered projects. The leaders of these projects can be local organizations, but they can also be just a group of people with a cool idea. If you have a project that needs funding or know someone who does, there is still time to apply. Go to the city website at corvallisoregon.gov and type Green Grants into the search bar to find more information. On March 26th, there will be a meeting of the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force. In fiscal year 2022-2023, city staff initiated an update of the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan. The update is following a public process outlined by the Corvallis City Council and involves a volunteer task force of community members with expertise in natural resources, ecology, and land management. More details on the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force, including meeting minutes, can be found on the city webpage and by attending the meetings of the task force. Meetings are both in person and virtual, and recordings of past meetings can be accessed via the city's archives and at vimeo.com/cityofcorvallis. On March 27th, the City Council's City Legislative Committee will hold their virtual-only meeting to discuss the 2025 State of Oregon legislative session. The meeting is at 4 p.m., and interested members of the public are encouraged to attend. Curious about what our city leaders think about what is happening in Salem? Keep up to date by watching this meeting. Details on how to attend can be found on the city's website, corvallisoregon.gov. And that's a wrap for the Corvallis Civics Cafe this week. If you have any comments or questions about the material I've shared, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's news, music, and civics, email us at news@korcfm.com. Thanks for tuning in to KORC's News, Music, and Civics show. The show airs on Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m. and repeats on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. And Civics Cafe can also be heard on Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. following the many moods of Ben Vaughn.
This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall. Hearing dates have been set for the landfill expansion application, and the public comment period is now open. The Benton County Planning Division has announced the schedule for the public hearing on Republic Services' conditional use permit application for the proposed expansion of the Coffin Butte landfill. The public comment period is now open. The following dates have been set for the hearing before the Benton County Planning Commission. On Tuesday, April 29th from 6 to 9 p.m., that will be day one, including the staff report, applicant presentation, and the start of public testimony if time permits. On Thursday, May 1st from 6 to 9 p.m., it will be day two, the starting or continuing of the public testimony. Tuesday, May 6th from 6 to 9 p.m., will be a continuation of public testimony as necessary. And on Tuesday, June 17th from 6 p.m. until whenever they complete the process, that will be day four with deliberations and decisions on the application for the landfill expansion. The hearing will be held at the county's Kalapuya building, which is located at 4500 Southwest Research Way in Corvallis. Anyone can sign up as an interested party to receive updates about the status of the application and changes or additions to the schedule. Members of the public can now submit written testimony about the CUP application. Comments should be submitted up to 8 days before the hearing begins to be included in the Planning Division staff report for the Planning Commission and agency referral partners. Written testimony received after the staff report is posted and up to the start of the public hearing will be delivered in hard copy to the Planning Commission. Written testimony submitted during the public hearing should be handed to the meeting recorder, and after the public hearing, all written comments that were not in the original staff report will be added to the record and posted to the county website in one action. Members of the public can also sign up to share verbal testimony during the hearing. An online sign-up system will be released about a week before the hearing begins, which is Tuesday, April 29th, the beginning of the hearing. Although this option will be available, the community is encouraged to provide written comments in advance so planning commission members, county staff, and the public have time to consider all perspectives and prepare to respond at the hearing. This also allows for the most efficient use of meeting time. Republic Services submitted additional material for the CUP application on March 14th of this year. This addendum to the burden of proof submitted on January 15th is publicly available on the MooneyDocs platform as Landfill Expansion Application, First Addendum to Burden of Proof. The Benton County Planning Division is working to incorporate this new information into the staff report. You can learn more about the decision process by visiting bentoncountyor.gov/coffin-butte-landfill. bentoncountyor.gov/coffin-butte-landfill. The hearing begins Tuesday, April 29th at 6 p.m. at the Kalapuya Building located on Research Way in Corvallis. This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall.
This is Wendy Byrne with a list of city meetings for the week starting March 23rd. On Tuesday, March 25th, there will be a meeting of the Corvallis Climate Action Advisory Board starting at 4:30 p.m. This meeting will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. The meeting is open to the public. The agenda and packet of materials for the meeting can be found on the city webpage at corvallisoregon.gov. On Wednesday, March 26th, there will be a meeting of the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force starting at 5 p.m. The Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting will be held both virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room. For meeting materials, including the agenda and electronic packet, and to register to attend remotely, see the city website at corvallisoregon.gov. The Madison Avenue Meeting Room is located at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. Also on Wednesday, March 26th, there will be an open house for the Downtown Parking Task Force starting at 5 p.m. Join city staff for an interactive discussion about the progress of the Downtown Parking Task Force, potential recommendations, and a look ahead to what the city is working on for 2025 and beyond. This meeting will take place at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. On Thursday, March 27th, there will be a meeting of the City Legislative Committee starting at 4 p.m. This meeting is online only. The public may sign up to watch this meeting virtually via a link at the city's website, corvallisoregon.gov.
Mahmoud Khalil, who has been detained and targeted for deportation by the Trump administration for speaking out about the atrocities in Gaza, dictated a letter to the public from his detention cell in Louisiana. Jacobin Magazine published the letter, and here it is in full. "My name is Mahmoud Khalil, and I am a political prisoner. I am writing to you from a detention facility in Louisiana, where I wake to cold mornings and spend long days bearing witness to the quiet injustices underway against a great many people precluded from the protections of the law. Who has the right to have rights? It is certainly not the humans crowded into the cells here. It is not the Senegalese man I met who has been deprived of his liberty for a year, his legal situation in limbo and his family an ocean away. It isn't the 21-year-old detainee I met who stepped foot in this country at age 9 only to be deported without so much as a hearing. Justice escapes the contours of this nation's immigration facilities. On March 8th, I was taken by Department of Homeland Security agents who refused to provide a warrant and accosted my wife and me as we returned from dinner. By now, the footage of that night has been made public. Before I knew what was happening, agents handcuffed and forced me into an unmarked car, At that moment, my only concern was for my wife's safety. I had no idea if she would be taken too, since the agents had threatened to arrest her for not leaving my side. DHS would not tell me anything for hours. I did not know the cause of my arrest or if I was facing immediate deportation. At 26 Federal Plaza in New York City, I slept on the cold floor. In the early morning hours, agents transported me to another facility in Elizabeth, New Jersey. There, I slept on the ground and was refused a blanket despite my request. My arrest was a direct consequence of exercising my right to free speech as I advocated for a free Palestine and an end to the genocide in Gaza, which resumed in full force Monday night. With January's ceasefire now broken, parents in Gaza are once again cradling two small shrouds, and families are forced to weigh starvation and displacement against bombs. It is our moral imperative to persist in the struggle for their complete freedom. I was born in a Palestinian refugee camp in Syria to a family that has been displaced from their land since the 1948 Nakba. I spent my youth in proximity to, yet distant from my homeland. But being Palestinian is an experience that transcends borders. I see in my circumstances similarities to Israel's use of administrative detention, imprisonment without trial or charge, to strip Palestinians of their rights. I think of our friend Omar Khatib, who is incarcerated without charge or trial by Israel as he returned home from travel. I think of Gaza hospital director and pediatrician Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, who was taken captive by the Israeli military on December 27th and remains in an Israeli torture camp today. For Palestinians, imprisonment without due process is commonplace. I have always believed that my duty is not only to liberate myself from the oppressor, but also to liberate my oppressors from their hatred and fear. My unjust detention is indicative of the anti-Palestinian racism that both the Biden and Trump administrations have demonstrated over the past 16 months, as the United States has continued to supply Israel with weapons to kill Palestinians and prevented international intervention. For decades, anti-Palestinian racism has driven efforts to expand U.S. laws and practices that are used to violently repress Palestinians, Arab Americans, and other communities. That is precisely why I am being targeted. While I await legal decisions that hold the futures of my wife and child in the balance, those who enabled my targeting remain comfortably at Columbia University, Presidents Manoush Shafiq, Katrina Armstrong, and Dean Karen Yarhi Milo laid the groundwork for the U.S. government to target me by arbitrarily disciplining pro-Palestinian students and allowing viral doxing campaigns based on racism and disinformation to go unchecked. Columbia targeted me for my activism, creating a new authoritarian disciplinary office to bypass due process and silence students criticizing Israel. Columbia surrendered to federal pressure by disclosing student records to Congress and yielding to the Trump administration's latest threats. My arrest, the expulsion or suspension of at least 22 Columbia students, some stripped of their BA degrees just weeks before graduation, and the expulsion of student workers of Columbia President Grant Miner on the eve of contract negotiations are clear examples. If anything, my detention is a testament to the strength of the student movement in shifting public opinion toward Palestinian liberation. Students have long been at the forefront of change, leading the charge against the Vietnam War, standing on the front lines of the civil rights movement, and driving the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. Today, too, even if the public has yet to fully grasp it, it is students who steer us toward truth and justice. The Trump administration is targeting me as part of a broader strategy to suppress dissent. Visa holders, green card carriers, and citizens alike will all be targeted for their political beliefs. In the weeks ahead, students, advocates, and elected officials must unite to defend the right to protest for Palestine. At stake are not just our voices, but the fundamental civil liberties of all. Knowing fully that this moment transcends my individual circumstances, I hope nonetheless to be free to witness the birth of my firstborn child. Mahmoud Khalil is a legal, permanent resident of the U.S. who is being detained and targeted for deportation by the Department of Homeland Security for protesting Israel's war on Gaza. We just heard a letter which he dictated on March 20th from his cell in Louisiana. This developing story potentially has major implications for anti-government protesters everywhere in the United States. It's also worth noting that from 2018 to 2022, Khalil was employed by the British government in the political and information section of the British Embassy in Lebanon. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics on 105.9 FM in Corvallis, Oregon, streaming 24/7 on KORCFM.com.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. The public is invited to learn about and discuss potential changes to parking downtown. There will be an open house this coming Wednesday, March 26th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Corvallis Benton County Public Library's main meeting room. They will provide light refreshments. On the agenda, starting at 5 o'clock, they will welcome, review project boards, and talk with Public Works staff. And starting at 5:35, they'll have a presentation, followed by a Q&A that starts just after 6 p.m. And then starting at 6:35 p.m., they will review project boards, talk with staff, and take a short survey from the public. If you are not able to make it in person, they will be doing this virtually as well. You can find out more information on that at corvallisoregon.gov/parking. The presentation and Q&A recording will be posted following this open house event that is this coming Wednesday, that's March 26th, 5 to 7 p.m. at the Corvallis Benton County Public Library main meeting room to discuss downtown parking. There is more information at corvallisoregon.gov/parking. Thanks for joining us for KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. It repeats Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. And you can find an archive of past shows at our website, korcfm.com. We're going to take a quick break from the news and check out a local artist. Here is Stacy Henley from her new album. Henley, by the way, is spelled H-E-N-L-E. The name of this track is Don't Pull Away. This is from Stacy Henley's new release, Kindness Floats.
Don't pull away, though it feels natural to do. Finally, what you want is here for you. No, don't pull away. Time I see it, same old story.
local artist Stacy Henley with her track Don't Pull Away. That's from her new release, Kindness Floats. You can do an internet search for Stacy Henley and find more of her music online. Stacy is S-T-A-C-Y. Her last name is H-E-N-L-E. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics.
Up next is a portion of Democracy Now!'s show from Friday, March 21st. You can learn more about the program and listen and watch full episodes at democracynow.org.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military has launched a full-scale ground invasion in Rafah as it relentlessly attacks the Gaza Strip for the fourth straight day since Israel unilaterally shattered the ceasefire with Hamas. Israeli troops are also pushing into the north near Beit Lahia and other areas. At least 200 Palestinian children have been killed in Israeli attacks since Tuesday. This is a mother in Khan Yunis whose daughter was killed in an Israeli strike.
Stop this war. Stop this extermination. This is an extermination of the entire Palestinian people. What is the fault of the children? These children, what is their fault? For every child you bring 100. What is this? Shame on you. The entire square, not a stone or anything remains. It is all destroyed. They left nothing in the whole area.
UNRWA has announced 5 of its workers have been killed in recent days. This brings the total of all UNRWA workers killed in Israeli attacks on Gaza over the past 18 months to 284. President Trump Thursday signed an executive order to start dismantling the Department of Education.
My administration will take all lawful steps to shut down the department. We're going to shut it down and shut it down as quickly as possible. It's doing us no good. We want to return our students to the states.
The department cannot be fully shut down without an act of Congress, but Trump's order directs Education Secretary Linda McMahon to shutter regional officers, transfer out some of its key functions, further slash the department's workforce, which has already been cut in half since Trump took office. The fate of public education, funding, labor, civil rights protections, financial aid for students now hangs in the balance. Protests are planned for today in D.C. and beyond. We'll have more on Trump's executive order and its implications after headlines. A federal judge temporarily blocked Elon Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, from accessing Social Security Administration databases containing personal information. Judge Ellen Hollander also ordered DOGE to delete identifiable personal data it may have already obtained and to remove software installed on Social Security systems. In her opinion, the judge wrote, the DOGE team is essentially engaged in a fishing expedition at SSA in search of a fraud epidemic based on little more than suspicion, she said. Federal Judge James Boasberg accused the Trump Justice Department of, quote, again evading their obligations and presenting woefully insufficient information around its deportation flights to Venezuelan immigrants under the Alien Enemies Act. Judge Boasberg had ordered the administration to present the information after it violated the judge's order last weekend to halt and turn around removal flights to El Salvador. Meanwhile, lawyers and loved ones of the deported individuals say they've been falsely accused of belonging to the Tren de Aragua gang simply because they have tattoos. One of them is professional soccer player Jerse Reyes Barrios. His lawyer says the tattoo that landed him on the deportation list depicts a crown sitting on top of a soccer ball with a rosary and the word Dios, God, chosen by Barrios as a nod to the Real Madrid soccer team logo. In Venezuela, families of deportees have pleaded to authorities to bring their loved ones home in reports of serious abuses at El Salvador's mega supermax prison where they're being held.
We ask the corresponding authorities, the UN, to please join us. We want to know the whereabouts of our children. Please return them to us if they are in El Salvador. They are not criminals.
In more immigration news, the private for-profit company GEO Group has announced a new contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement that'll see the reopening of a shuttered Michigan prison to start detaining immigrants and asylum seekers. The Northlake facility in Baldwin would become one of the largest ICE jails in the country with a capacity of at least 1,800 people. Northlake closed in 2022 as part of President Biden's executive order to end the use of private prisons by federal government. Detention Watch Network said in a statement, quote, the perverse financial incentives are glaring as GEO Group stands to generate an excess of $70 million in annualized revenue from Northlake at the expense of people's lives, unquote. GEO Group's stock value has soared since Trump returned to office. This comes as the National Labor Relations Board has dropped a case accusing GEO Group of retaliating against immigrant detainees who protested over low pay and dangerous working conditions. Detainees are paid as little as $1 a day for their labor. President Trump rescinded an executive order targeting the law firm Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton & Garrison after meeting in person with its chair this week. Under the deal, the law firm will provide $40 million in free legal services supporting Trump's agenda, including his task force to combat anti-Semitism. Last week, Trump's order threatened to revoke the firm's security clearances and end its federal contracts over its association with former partner Mark Pomerantz, who oversaw the Manhattan District Attorney's probe into Trump's finances. The news has set off alarm in the legal profession. The firm is associated with Democratic causes and is known for fighting civil rights cases against the government. The White House denied reports Elon Musk will be briefed on potential war plans with China when he visits the Pentagon today. The meeting represents a significant expansion of Musk's access to sensitive government information and underscores his many conflicts of interest. His companies, including SpaceX and Tesla, have received billions of dollars in government contracts, including with the Pentagon, and Musk has major financial interests in China. Rwanda-backed M23 fighters have seized another key town in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The rebel group entered the mining hub of Walikale on Wednesday. M23's latest advance comes after Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan President Paul Kagame called for an immediate ceasefire in the Eastern DRC following peace talks in Doha mediated by Qatar. But M23 leaders are not backing down.
On a mis des prix pour nous arrêter. Nous n'avons plus rien à perdre.
They have put prices on our arrest. We have nothing more to lose. We will fight until our cause is heard. Meanwhile, what happened in Doha, as long as we don't know the details and as long as it doesn't solve our problems, we will say it does not concern us.
In Sudan, military forces have recaptured the presidential palace in Khartoum, a major victory for the Sudanese army after nearly 2 years of war against the rapid support forces. Over 28,000 people have been killed since the conflict began in April 2023, with millions forcibly displaced from their homes in what the UN has described as the world's largest humanitarian crisis. In Turkey, mass protests continue over the arrest of Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu, a major rival to Turkey's authoritarian president Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Turkish authorities have detained at least 37 people over social media posts in support of İmamoğlu, who was taken into custody Wednesday on what his backers say are trumped-up charges ahead of primary elections on Sunday. Protesters took to the streets of Istanbul.
Bugün Türkiye demokrasisine bir darbe yapıldı, sivil darbe.
This is a coup to the national will and democracy. When viewed from foreign countries today, Turkey is seen as having an appearance where democracy is over, justice is over, and everyone who is not with the government is in prison. Do you actually know what this is like? It is proof that now the one-man regime is saying that there are no elections in Turkey. I am king. There will be no elections.
At least 6 people have been killed, another 40 still missing after a rubber dinghy carrying refugees capsized Tuesday in the Mediterranean off the Italian island of Lampedusa. Only 10 survivors have been rescued. The boat departed from Sfax, Tunisia, and the passengers were from Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Guinea, and Mali. At least 270 refugees have already died this year trying to cross the Mediterranean to seek safety in Europe. Over 30 UCLA students who were brutalized last spring during Gaza solidarity protests have sued campus officials and law enforcement agencies. Students had set up peaceful campus encampment demanding an end to UCLA's financial ties with Israel's war. But they were repeatedly targeted for abuse, including from outside groups, culminating in what they call a brutal mob assault on April 30th. The live-streamed attacks on students and faculty were carried out for at least 4 hours while UCLA security stood by. The university called in police the following day to forcefully and violently remove the protesters. The plaintiffs describe enduring physical and psychological harm. This is Binyamin Moryasef, an Israeli-American undergraduate plaintiff who accused UCLA of anti-Semitism over its silencing of Jewish anti-genocide voices on campus.
This lawsuit asks for the barest of respect towards the right to free expression, the right to voice our righteous opposition to the ever-present reality of imminent death every Palestinian child faces so long as the Israeli military continues its aggression. I ask the university not to collaborate with the oppressive forces of our time, unless they wish to be remembered like the heartless administration that arrested the Vietnam War protesters. Choose now to stand on the side of justice.
Meanwhile, at Cornell University here in New York State, outspoken international student activist Mamadou Tal has filed a lawsuit along with two others seeking to block Trump's executive orders targeting Palestinian rights activists. The three Cornell plaintiffs argue they've been unconstitutionally silenced. Last year, Mamadou Tal, a British and Ghanaian national, was twice suspended for his activism by Cornell, which moved to cancel a student visa, but ultimately backed down. Tal says law enforcement agents started following him around after he filed his lawsuit earlier this week. Supporters at Cornell mobilized Thursday to demand hands off Mamadou. Last month, Tal told Democracy Now! Why he would never stop advocating for Palestinian rights.
When we say Palestine is a litmus test, we're saying that it is not that we privilege the Palestinian cause among over every other cause, but rather Palestine holds a mirror up into the world and says, what kind of world do we want to live in?
To see our full interview with Mamadou Tal, go to democracynow.org. On Thursday, organizers say more than 1,000 Jewish activists from groups including If Not Now and Jews for Racial and Economic Justice rallied in front of the Manhattan headquarters of ICE to demand the release of Columbia student activist Mahmoud Khalil, who was picked up by federal immigration agents March 8th and remains in a Louisiana detention center. Two House Democrats have openly called for Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer to be replaced amid mounting anger over his vote backing the GOP government spending package. Congress members Glenn Ivey and Delia Ramirez made the comments during recent town halls. Senator Schumer was forced to postpone his book tour amidst widespread voter backlash and planned protests. Meanwhile, the Democratic National Committee announced it's going to host town halls in Republican-held House districts around the country. And in related news, Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has joined Senator Bernie Sanders as he continues his Fighting Oligarchy tour, addressing packed crowds and overflow rooms in Republican and swing districts across the United States. The pair addressed 5,000 people in Tempe, Arizona on Thursday.
We're not going to allow you and your friend, Mr. Musk, and the other billionaires to wreak havoc on the working families of this country. No, you're not going to destroy Social Security. You're not going to destroy Medicaid. You're not going to destroy the Veterans Administration.
Bernie Sanders has been visiting areas where the district's own congressional representatives have neglected to meet with constituents. House Speaker Mike Johnson has urged fellow Republicans to avoid town hall meetings after confrontations with concerned voters. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump signed an executive order Thursday to start dismantling the Department of Education, though the agency can't be formally shut down without congressional approval. Since taking office, Trump's already slashed the department's workforce in half and cut $600 million in grants. Trump's executive order instructs Education Secretary Linda McMahon to begin shutting down the agency.
My administration will take all lawful steps to shut down the department. We're going to shut it down and shut it down as quickly as possible. It's doing us no good. We want to return our students to the states where just some of the governors here are so happy about this. They want education to come back to them, to come back to the states, and they're going to do a phenomenal job.
For the signing ceremony, Trump created a fake classroom inside the White House, flanked by school children sitting at desks. They were given fake executive orders to sign as well. Many groups have criticized the move to shut down the department. Kerry Rodriguez, president of the National Parents Union, said, quote, let's be clear. Before federal oversight, millions of children, particularly those with disabilities and those from our most vulnerable communities, were denied the opportunities they deserved, she said. Gerald Griggs, the president of Georgia's NAACP, also criticized Trump's move.
Everybody says they want to support children. They have a right to life. But what happens after they're born? They have to be educated. And if you're cutting the Department of Education, whose sole purpose is to provide a quality education for all of Americans, but particularly those that are in public schools, I think this is ill-fated and will be very detrimental to this state and the United States.
The White House says several critical programs will continue, including student loans and federal Pell Grants. We go now to Gloucester, Massachusetts. We're joined by Jennifer Berkshire, co-author of the book The Education Wars, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual. She's also host of the education podcast Have You Heard? Her recent piece for The Baffler is headlined Cruel to Your School, Trump's War on Public Education. Jennifer Berkshire, thanks so much for being with us. Why don't you start off by explaining what the Department of Education does?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. And when it comes to the Department of Education, it's so easy to venture into the weeds and to get lost in those programs and the acronyms. But when you quoted Kerry Rodriguez, she was exactly right. Those programs, those things like Title I, they were set up in order to smooth out the vast disparities that we've long had in this country, that disparities between kids based on race, where they live. And so the Department of Education provides 10% of education funding around the country, primarily to low-income schools and rural schools. And when you think about the real focus of the efforts of the Trump administration to weed out what they would call woke or DEI, this is really it. It's anything that the government does to make the country more equal. That's why they're going straight at these programs. And it's also why public education as an institution is so vulnerable right now.
Talk about children with disabilities. You know, there's the whole discussion of DEI, of diversity, equity, and inclusion. But it really actually is DEIA, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. Can you explain, Jennifer?
Yes, absolutely. So people don't realize just how recent it is in this country that students with disabilities are guaranteed the right for a free and appropriate education. You can still meet people who came of age in the 70s and had, you know, siblings who didn't have, school could just turn them away because they had a disability. And because we have a law in the books called IDEA, Linda McMahon did not know what it stands for, but it is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And so basically, students have a right that's enforced through the Department of Education. And so it's no coincidence at all that in those layoffs that you mentioned, they went really hard at the division that enforces civil rights. The overwhelming majority of civil rights complaints are from parents who are seeking services and access for kids with disabilities. And basically, the department is saying now, you know what? We're no longer going to enforce your right. Instead, we're going to turn what's left of our civil rights division into a sort of a weaponized, lean machine that goes after alleged acts of anti-Semitism, and then also things that they suspect of having to do with gender ideology.
And Trump vowing to fully preserve popular programs like Pell Grants?
That was a real tell, I thought, that you heard him talk about preserving programs that, the Department of Education now oversees, things like Title I and funding for special education and Pell Grants, because he knows that getting rid of these programs would be very politically unpopular. And so he's sort of talking about it in the same way that they're talking about Social Security and Medicare. Like, we see them off stage mucking about, but we're being assured that there won't be any interruption in essential services. But as we know from reading the playbook, that would be Project 2025, the goal is not to continue to spend the same amount of money, but just in a different way. It's ultimately to phase out spending. It's to privatize the loan portfolio and make it more difficult and more expensive for kids to go to college. And these are things that I think are really unpopular with American voters across party lines, which is why you don't hear the Trump folks really, you know, admitting where their ultimate destination is.
Jennifer Berkshire, how does this executive order fit into the broader war on public education?
It was really telling to see who Trump picked to join him in that weird scene where he signed the order. So you have the kids at the desk, but then you have some of his favorite governors. Now, why are they his favorite governors? Because they are all in states that either have or in the process of implementing what are called universal school vouchers. So this means that the state now picks up the tab for parents to send their kids to private religious schools. And most importantly, like, that money is not going to pay the cost of kids who are leaving public schools. It's now going to pay the tuition for parents who already sent their kids to private religious schools, which means that increasingly in states like Ohio and Indiana, you have the government paying for the very wealthy to send their kids to private religious schools. So why would this be your vision? Because if Trump had wanted to assemble, like the states that are doing the best on, say, standardized tests, this would not be the crew you'd have, right? Florida was so unhappy with how it fared on the latest round of what we call the nation's report card that the Secretary of Education wrote to complain that the test was rigged. And think about somebody like Indiana, your governor's there. Indiana stopped investing in public education, K-12 and higher education, 15 years ago. And as a result, college attendance has plummeted and the state is doing really poorly economically. I think it's actually very indicative of where Trump sees us heading, which is to a sort of a meaner, less prosperous, more divided and inequitable future. And you saw it right there on that weird set.
And how this relates to Project 2025 and Christopher Rufo, Jennifer?
Yeah, so they're basically, they have laid out the playbook, and it's really important to pay attention to what they've been telling us all along. I see so many commentators scratching their heads wondering, you know, what are they up to? Why are they focused on these programs? But we've got, say, a Christopher Rufo out there saying that his goal is to see the percentage of kids who attend college drop by half. Right. That tells you something about the vision that's out there. When Trump talks about returning education to the states, he's talking about the vision that was laid out in Project 2025. And that is really sending funding back to the states in the form of block grants that they can do whatever they want with. Well, we know what they want to do with the money because we saw who was on that stage yesterday. They want to devote an increasing percentage of their education dollars to private and religious schools that don't have to accept all kids. It's a real step backwards, and it's one that I think that we should all reject.
Finally, what causes you most alarm as President Trump promises to shutter the Department of Education, though somehow needs congressional approval at the very end?
What gives me most alarm is what a poor job the Democrats have been doing. Speaking up on behalf of public education as an institution and reminding us why we need it and what we stand to lose when it disappears. And I'm hoping that as we start to possibly see some signs of life among the Democrats that they will lean into this issue. So that both gives me hope, but it also causes me not a slight amount of despair right now.
Jennifer Berkshire, co-author of The Education Wars, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual, will link to your new article in The Baffler, Cruel to Your School, Trump's War on Public Education.
That was a segment of Democracy Now! From their Friday, March 21st show. More information, including full episodes, can be found at democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC.
Spring began this past Thursday, March 20th, and it's going to be the spring season until June 20th, at which time it will be summer. In the meantime, we at KORC News, Music, and Civics hope to bring you local information that is relevant and useful. If you would like to be a part of what we are doing here on KORC News, Music, and Civics, send us an email, info@korcfm.com. This is Dan Krall. Thank you for listening to today's program. We're going to conclude with the sounds of the Jackson Fraser Wetland, located in the north end of town. I recorded this back in 2006 or 2007, and if you were to make a trek up that way, you'd probably notice that the ecosystem sounds a little different than these days, but you will notice the birds and frogs and other creatures within this soundscape recorded in either 2006 or 2007 at the Jackson Fraser Wetland. This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. Happy spring.
This is JC from The Lost Court. If you want to hear lost music and found treasures, check me out on Thursdays at 5 and Saturdays at 5. I play Patti Smith, David Bowie, music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, even new modern shit. Hey, man, my school is insane. Check me out on Thursdays and Saturdays at 5 o'clock. That's me, JC, and the Lost Cork.